Hi, this is John Janik. Welcome back to another DevCast. So it's been a while. We've had a lot of things going on here at Dev Technology Group and lots of great things happening. Can't wait to share some of them with you. And in fact, today is a very special conversation because we're going to be talking about something that Dev did on April 5th with a lot of help. And I mean that sincerely. We had some spectacular guests. We had some spectacular help from the company to make it happen. So many thank yous and warm congratulations on an event well executed to all of them. And most importantly, we had an audience of about 30 people split right down the middle between government and academia and commercial that made for a really impactful conversation around innovation. And so that's what our conversation is going to be today. An opportunity to reflect on what we had just been covering, talk a little bit about it. And I am joined today by Tina Ellers, who is our Associate Controller for Dev Technology Group, and also currently in an MBA program at James Madison University that's focused on innovation. So she's got a real opportunity here to give us some interesting insights into both current academic thinking around innovation and how applied innovation, especially, is kind of put to use and what she saw in the meeting. So first off, I want to say hi, Tina. Thanks for joining us on today's DevCast.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
And just a little bit of context for everybody who's listening. So on April 5th, we had a great panel conversation led by Renata Spinks, who's a former deputy CIO over at the Marine Corps, has been doing IT work for a very, very long time, and now is the founder of her own IT and cybersecurity firm. And she's a phenomenal force of nature, wonderful person, fantastic moderator and panel leader. And she led the conversation, and she was joined by Colonel Chris Sailing, who's the current head of the Innovation Directorate at the U.S. Army Recruiting Command, Molly Moran, who's the associate chair at the Emerging Technology in Business and Design program at Miami University, and Tom Mills, who is the executive director for the Cargo Systems program at the Customs and Border Protection Agency. So three people who have spent their entire career focused on mission and delivering capabilities and having conversations with other people about how to move the needle forward. What a powerful stage in which to start a conversation between all of the participants. So again, this wasn't just a talking heads panel. The reason why we bring these folks together is to challenge and engage with the audience in a meaningful way. And so all throughout this conversation, we had an audience participation tool called Slido up and running so that people could ask questions, and they did. It was great. We had kind of a continuous feedback loop going where people were able to engage and articulate questions and thoughts. And lots of fantastic conversation came out of that back and forth between the panel and the audience. And so, Tina, I know you were sitting in that room with our colleagues and coworkers during that conversation. I wanted to kind of take this opportunity to turn it to you and tell a little bit about your experiences in that room, hearing the conversation that was happening up front, and also some of your own thinking.
The conversation was great. It was very engaging the entire time. The questions asked by the audience and even prepared questions by the moderator were very useful into getting an insight into how leadership can successfully execute innovation, how feedback or ideas can be submitted for innovation, which, you know, that's very important to figure out a way to have these ideas submitted. How are they vetted so that we can use our resources effectively? They also talked about, you know, blockers, having innovation move forward. And I think that is very interesting for organizations across the board.
So when we talk about it, in terms of, you know, we kind of had three different lanes set up for the conversation, and we did that intentionally, and it worked out really well because it turns out that when we talk about innovation, we oftentimes talk about it on those different lanes as well. We had people and teams. How do we enable and empower individuals and teams to kind of carry the flag. We talked about organizations and institutions, those kinds of big construct. You know, we always talk about how we want to work for an innovative company, or we want to be a part of an innovative organization. What does that mean? Because a person and a team can both be innovative. And as we start to scale, it becomes more and more complex, and it requires more and more energy in order to kind of sustain a truly innovative organization. So there's a lot of discussion around there. And then finally, this perspective, talking a lot about, well, now how do we actually put that to work and integrate innovation into our daily activities, our daily programs, the mission work that we're actually doing? And one of the most common discussions that were right out of the gate, right, was around team psychological safety and having a good sense of trust and being able to both engage, interact, challenge, and cooperate towards kind of common sets of problems and solutions. That was just a really interesting take. Of course, it's reinforced by tons of academic research on the topic. It's been a very hot topic for at least the last, I think, 10 or 15 years, coming out of a lot of Google's work and others, that, you know, we know now that psychological safety and team cohesiveness generates a tremendous amount of energy that can then be focused on innovative ideas. And I guess that's the other part of it, is that when we talk about innovation, it's really talking about the applied methodology of something new or novel as a way that represents a significant advantage over the status quo or the previous way of doing things, right? So we've got a couple of different things that right out of the gate we kind of talked about as a room that both set the definition and expectation around what is innovation. When we use this word, what does it mean for us? It's not necessarily a product. It can be an approach. It can be a process, right? It can be an improvement on a process. It can be a policy. There's lots of different ways to approach this. And how we think about it is really based on how we operate as individuals and teams, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I just add to the building of trust. I mean, I think that is hugely important, you know, for successful execution and participation. Building trust and enabling a mechanism to recognize success and reward for people. Also, building a culture that allows for failure and to learn lessons from those failures as well, without teammates being, you know, in fear of losing that trust or not feeling like they want to participate because they're afraid. Diverse teams also. I'm not sure if we touched on diversity, but having different perspectives is also very important into creating innovation and executing the innovation. People will come at innovation ideas and solutions from different directions.
Well, so speaking of diversity and diversity of thought, diversity of perspective, one of the things we did talk a lot about was the impact of human-centered design in trying to understand what is our problem that we're trying to solve and how might we collectively work towards solving that problem, right? It's inherent in the design methodology that we're going to bring together a lot of different ideas and we're going to try a bunch of stuff and we're going to fail a bunch of times, right? And I know during this session, we didn't talk about failure probably as much as we could or should have, because nobody likes to talk about failure, right? But to your point, so I used to say this often when I was in the State Department, when we find ways to fail in small ways, we don't fail in big ways. And that's because there are learning opportunities kind of interwoven in between all of those small failures that create the necessary kind of experience and context so that when you get to the big things that do matter, you have taken all the necessary steps to build that experience and context for navigating that decision, right? So I think that, you know, we talked around a lot of those things. We spent a lot of time kind of talking through the impact of human-centered design on innovation and how it can create better discussions around innovation. You know, one of the things I thought was really interesting was the comments about scaling innovation, right? And how do you take an idea that is new and different and thoughtful and actually get it to the point where it is making a difference and impactful and operational? So, Tina, One of the things that, you know, it's kind of building on some of the conversation we've had so far. One of the things that was really different, unique, that we've tried very hard to kind of have persistent in this space is this ongoing conversation between the room and the panelists. Tell me a little bit about what you were thinking, some of the questions you had. Did you get a chance to ask any questions? Were there questions that you wanted to ask that you didn't get an opportunity to ask? Tell me a little bit about what you were thinking and kind of processing as you were in that room listening to those comments.
All the questions that were coming up on the board and being asked were similar to what I would have had. Some of the themes that jumped out at me were increasing leadership appetite for innovation. Just hearing some of my cohort in my MBA program talk about trying to get innovation, you know, up all the way up to leadership seemed to be difficult at times. So some of the feedback or recommendations we got from the panel were, you know, maybe run the testing in parallel, you know, try to get a dedicated team so that you don't disrupt operations. I think for dev in our size, that's not always possible. Large organizations, potentially, yes. And then if you're going to bring an idea forward, maybe do the legwork first. You know, what is it? The what of that is identifying the problem, possibly the solution, and some data to back it up. And the how is, of that is to think through the design and implementation of it. And I think when you come prepared and have a possible solution to your innovation idea, I think that you'll get more ears on those innovations. Another theme we touched on this a little bit was the keys to successful execution from a leadership standpoint. We talked about trust and change management. But the other thing, I think one of my big takeaways was staying flexible, and you're going to have a diverse team is the ideal. And in that case, you're going to want to keep the focus moving and the effort moving in the same direction. And I think that's a challenge for, you know, leaders bringing in multiple teams, but maybe have some design thinking training for those leaders so they understand maybe the process a little more. Collecting innovation ideas. Ideas are really insightful for identifying unknown problems. There's a mechanism to collect those ideas and vet them. Maybe we'll uncover things that we didn't know and where we have a opportunity to innovate or change a process. Like you said, it could just be a process. Measuring success. When I did the innovation audit on dev as part of my MBA program, measuring innovation was, you know, a little bit of a stumper when I asked that question. And our panelists came up with some really good suggestions, like research other companies' case studies and find out what their results were. You know, is there something, lessons learned there? You know, we talked about failure a little bit ago earlier in this podcast, and, you know, there we could learn from other companies' failures. And what did they do to resolve it? We might not get all of that information, but we can get some ideas. And then measurement should also measure how we get to a target. So what was the impact or results? You know, track our failures, allow for failure. Here's what we tried and what didn't work and why it didn't work. Measure between outcome and output. Refer back to the design thinking to be able to measure impact and outcomes. And from there, you really need to know your definition of done.
So let's talk a little bit about that. I want to unpack that because brought up colloquialisms, right? Good, which is Goddard's law. When a target becomes, or when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure, right? Because it becomes the outcome that you're seeking to create. And in almost all the cases that we heard about, right, where it was like pure idea generation or something like that, it became something of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's interesting, the Human Resources Command over U.S. Army had an industry day last week. I asked the head of acquisitions, Mike Carroll, a couple of questions, and his comment was they wanted to do certain things to avoid innovation theater, right? And so I think they're all kind of interconnected when you think about how do we use data to understand a problem? How do we use data to answer a hypothesis? How do we use data to understand additional context, background, and kind of atmospherics around a particular problem area, right? All of these things kind of feed into each other. And we do have to be pretty careful, right? Because if we don't pick the right data, or if we don't understand, and to your point earlier about being flexible, if we're not flexible enough to say, oh, maybe we're not actually getting after the right thing here. Maybe we're not looking at it the right way. Maybe we need to think about this in a slightly different approach, right? Then we're constraining ourselves. I'm wondering if there's any other kind of specific aha moments. Was there something you heard that was like, all of a sudden it just had the light bulb went off, you know, like, yes, this makes so much more sense now. And you've mentioned a number of different things that were like, this was very helpful in reinforcing some of the things you've been learning in your MBA program. But tell me about like a particularly incredible light bulb thing that where you had that aha moment.
I think one of my biggest ones was around when you're implementing change, and I'm changing the subject just a little bit, but when you're implementing change, use empathy when suggesting change. I think that's easy to forget because as the innovator, we tend to look at our own viewpoint and we're not taking into account the outcome of what we're thinking. Maybe we don't understand other processes, what other teams do, the impact fully. We need to be able to communicate in a way that makes sense what our change is going to be. Offer options, time box the solution, you know, so it's not kind of getting away from us. You talked about moving targets. So kind of looking at it in an iterative approach to make sure that we're on, you know, are we on the right track? Is our innovation or our innovation efforts going in the direction where we thought, as we defined as a definition of done, or do we need to change direction, be more flexible?
That's a really great point about change. And I don't think it's a whole lot different or off topic, because it was a really powerful statement when somebody was talking about it in an international context, and that change is really, really hard when you have a lot of different stakeholders engaged and involved. And I think you're absolutely right in that the more complex the environment, the stakeholders, the problem set that you're trying to affect, right? The more complexity in the environment, the more change is going to be challenged. It's going to be painful in some ways, right? Because, you know, in any kind of standard distribution of a population, you said it yourself, you know, innovators sometimes lose sight of the fact that they're on the leading edge of that curve, sometimes by an extreme amount, right? The true innovators that are kind of blazing the trail, maybe in that top, you know, 1-5% of the population curve. And there's a tremendous tail on that that still has to come along to some extent. You can't leave everybody behind. So yeah, I agree. I think that was a really interesting part of the conversation. I think it was very insightful to connect those two in a meaningful way. And going back to, you know, Mike Carroll's comments during the industry day conversation, you can't have innovation for innovation's sake, right? Innovation, to go back to some of the definitional stuff that we've talked about, right? The reason why we innovate, and by the way, innovation as a word has only come into use in the last 100 years or so. Even I think it was somewhere in the 19 or maybe late 1800s, but it hasn't been in particular. I remember looking at the engrams for the word when I was in a government role many years ago, but, you know, mostly because we talk about it as a construct, as a thing, as a process unto itself. And to your point about like, how do we manage change? It's really understanding and accepting that innovation and change are practically synonyms. And so we have to understand how a significant advance in how we do something also necessitates an equal proportion and investment in making sure we all know how to do the new thing together, right?
Right. I was just going to add, you know, just to reiterate, the outreach and communication is so important to change. And Harmony, when you're going into your innovation process or you get your team together, and you brought this up earlier, is harmonizing how the data is collected is super important. If you don't have good data going into your design thinking and testing, you're going to spin your wheels and you're going to end up somewhere where you didn't plan on being. So in the common mindset is also, is everyone on the same page, you know, for that change? And it starts with our leaders, you know, and our team and our stakeholders. We need to think about all of them together. And then I'm just going to circle right back to communication, communicating what we're doing and why we're doing it. And change is hard. You know, we've definitely had some really good examples in my cohort. One example was the billing at UVA Hospital was being changed. The codes were being changed. And the manager just could not get buy-in from anybody to make those changes. And there was a lot of pushback. So it really took a team effort to get that change made. And it was to create a more effective and efficient billing process for the hospital and for the patients. But there had to be communication and creating a common mindset among all the players from the top all the way down to the tails that you were talking about earlier, John.
Yeah. You know, sometimes, and I think we heard this in the conversation too, it's even about, and this is something I think that happens probably less frequently than it should. And it really kind of comes back to design thinking too. One of the most important concepts around design thinking is this idea that we're going to have a common definition and perspective on the problem that we're trying to solve. We're going to agree that this is the problem that we're trying to solve, and that it's important, and that it's worth our time, and that it's worth our energy to find a resolution to. And we don't know what that resolution is going to look like. And I think sometimes we end up trying to solve the problem before we've had a discussion about what the problem is. At least one of the things that I heard in that discussion panel was that spending time discussing and building confidence and trust around this is a problem that needs to be solved and we all need to spend time on this and this is how we're going to approach it, or even, and I think there were some good examples during the discussion as well, that like, even if it's like, we all recognize that this is a problem and this group has been asked to kind of lead out on a solution for that problem, I think is a really important thing to remind ourselves by, because sometimes we get ahead of ourselves. You know, sometimes people come to the table with solutions, and the process of building ownership and a true stakeholder trust begins with establishing and agreeing on what is the problem we're trying to solve, right?
Absolutely. And I think one of our panelists recommended the first thing you do is when you have your CROWIST collaborative team, map out visually what the whole process is. And that way, each team member or stakeholder in that team can say, oh, no, we do this here. We do this differently than what you have here. And then you get a nice picture of what the process is, what the legs are of those process, what of that process or processes. A lot of times it's multiple processes that link up to that main process. And I think when you do that, you all, like, as you said, John, start from the same place once that work has been done. And once there's a visual of that process, so everybody can see, okay, this is where we're at, and this is where we're trying to go.
Yeah, 100%. I know we've had conversations around value stream mapping before, process mapping. So I'm kind of curious from your perspective, where you've had some of these conversations and engagements, you know, these are things that take time and energy. And oftentimes the people that are asked to do them already have full-time jobs. And one of the things we heard during the panel was, how do you make time and space for this kind of work? Because, you know, I've heard it said before, and I'm a big believer in it, transparency is a perfect disinfectant. If you have disagreements over policy, if you have disagreements over procedure, the most impactful thing you can do is to visualize it, diagram it, make sure everybody's clear on, well, what is it supposed to be, or what is it in practice now, so that we can then talk about it and understand it and have a discussion around the process rather than the people or the outcome or the outputs of those processes, right? So that when you're thinking about those things, you're absolutely right in that the more you can expose and be transparent about and make it so that it is an object that can be inspected and, you know, ostensibly criticized, but also accepted, right? That allows you to then have a conversation around the thing instead of any particular players or any particular policies or any particular approaches. And by the way, so you and I and the other accounting teams, like we embarked on a little innovation project recently, right? And I think that's a really good case example where we had a good conversation around, because we came to the table with some notions, some ideas, some thoughts, but we very quickly realized that like that wasn't going to get us where we needed to go. And so we all sat down. I sat down with the accounting team, right? We had a very constructive conversation around, well, what, describe the problem to me. Tell me where the pain is. And then we can start thinking about how might we resolve that? How might we understand it? How might we create opportunities for improvement, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a very successful project that we worked on. So thank you for that, you know, extra time on your part for helping us go through that. I also think when you're looking at a problem and you're pulling people out of their day-to-day, you know, to hopefully not disrupt operations, right? So there may be some extra time being put in from those participants. I think the level of the pain point also might influence people to kind of work a little bit extra on what the issue is. You know, for example, we had cross collaboration with our talent team, HR team, business operations team, county, and some leadership around how do we get the information we need for new hires to the right people. And it was, to me, it was, and maybe this is just my perspective, but it was a big enough pain point where we had multiple, you know, long meetings around it, but everybody was very engaged. Once we did plot, you know, what's going on now? What are we doing now? Who needs what? That's where we started with our process. And then we did engage, I believe we engaged IT after the stakeholders got into place. IT is also a stakeholder in this one as well. But we tried to figure out solutions around, you know, do we use our existing software? Some of the answer was yes in that case. Others was, okay, we brought on this new payroll software. Do we use that? Some of it is yes. So we might not have had like the ideal solution at the end, but we got to the point where we weren't missing information anymore regarding new hires, onboarding new hires. So that was, to me, probably a good example because there were pain points and a lot of buy-in. I think that's key. There was a lot of buy-in once we learned what each other needed and it made our team cohesive. So just going back to, you know, having that process mapped out, but not just from one direction, from all directions, all the stakeholders that need that. And then how can we innovate from there?
Yep. So what you've described is a value stream, right? So a value stream ends up with some kind of value being delivered to an end user. And in this particular case, the end user is an onboarding employee, right? So there's a lot of different moving parts around how do you create that cohesive approach to delivering value in the terms of the onboarding packages and the payroll and all the different things that go into that, right? And so, you know, it's really important to understand and diagram out and to have that as a living document. And it's tough. I think you mentioned one other thing that is really important, and that is in one of the panelists brought this up, and then it was just kind of a conversation amongst the entire group that I thought was absolutely fantastic. And that said, we don't spend enough time recognizing the collaborative effort that goes into innovation, right? So for your example that you gave, right? You know, we didn't take the time to really recognize the entire group. And by the way, that's not a particular accusation or insinuation, right? It's more that it's a very true statement that in the same way that we don't talk about failure, we oftentimes don't talk about success except as individuals. And we'll like, that person is a real innovator, or that person is, right? So it's very interesting to me that oftentimes we don't recognize innovation for the collaborative community effort that it is. And we don't recognize failures for the collaborative community effort that it is, right? We always want to kind of assert or align that with an individual, which I just find absolutely fascinating. Because to your point, in almost every single case, I was talking recently, this has been a couple of years ago now, somebody who was on the team that invented the OLED, right? A game-changing technology. And it was a team of researchers. In almost every single use case where an innovation was a game changer, it was a team of researchers. And yet, we continually come back to this idea that there are individuals who are innovators. So kind of curious what you think. Like, is that something your class is talking about? How do we help change that to the idea that we want to give recognition and credit to the contributions that people make to help move the needle when they're doing so in a substantive way, right? If you're part of the team that moves the needle, then you need to be recognized for that.
We did touch on that. And it comes back to culture, I think, and expectations. The organization wants to set out around innovation as a culture. And part of that culture, there's, you know, subsets like, you know, risk tolerance and rewards and recognition. And maybe some companies or organizations need to look at that and say, do we have a mechanism in place to recognize the success or failure, or just in general, to your point, recognize the team that put in the effort, whether it was a success or a failure. I think that's really important. I think that increases motivation for people to participate, because whether you're successful or it's a failed innovation effort, there's a lot of time and effort and collaboration that goes into these innovation efforts. So I think you're right. I think having it on both sides, not just that you're an organization that accepts failure as part of it, you know, as maybe a learning process, but just recognition. I think that's huge for motivation and building trust, because perhaps, you know, this team of people that worked on this effort spent a lot of time outside of their operation working hours, right? And they were dedicated and they believed in what they were doing, but then there was no recognition at the end. So what's their motivation to participate the next time?
And I think you see that in organizations of all sizes, right? You see it in big government organizations. You see it in small organizations. I also want to come back to one thing I think that is probably important, and I remember hearing in the panel, and it's definitely something that we need to kind of put a pin in here too, which is that if you fail and you didn't learn anything, then you did truly fail, right? And so we talk about failure, and we talk about it as something that we should strive for, but what we really talk about is learning, right? So we want to go into this mode of we have data, we have a hypothesis around an outcome or an output that will improve the status quo, and we want to try something that's going to shift the needle on that, right? And if we do it successfully, then that's great. And people applaud that. And there's lots of accolades and people get promoted and it's wonderful. And occasionally people make lots of money, right? But it's just as important. And in fact, in a lot of ways, when you talk to people who do this for a living, they'll say, you learn a lot more when you try something and it doesn't work and you learn from that, right? So I think too, it's important to make sure that we're tying kind of that fail loop, because I'm a big believer in like fail festivals and, you know, failing frequently and often, but only as a mechanism for learning, because it's part of that scientific method. And I think that's something that's really important to kind of talk about. Failing, if you run at a wall and you knock yourself out, and you stand up and you do it again, you're just failing, right? You're just doing the same thing over and over and over again. And so I think it's important to fail as a path to learning and succeeding. And it's important to kind of put those lines in a dot. What's the other, I realize it's apocryphal, I don't think he ever said it, but what's that other thing that is attributed to Edison, right? I didn't come up with a light bulb. I came up with 10,000 ways not to do a light bulb, right?
Yeah, I think that's really important. And having a learning culture, which we definitely do at Dev, is really important. And, you know, failures might actually, as you mentioned, they will allow you to learn from them. But again, I think it ties back to the culture as well. Collecting data and understanding that data around failure, you know, results of tests that fail, you know, create a new use case and something else that might need to be addressed that we didn't think about. So maybe we failed on the intent of the innovation we started with, but perhaps it's opened our eyes to something else. There's a lot of outcomes of failure that are positive in innovation.
I really like that point too, that even if you don't succeed in the initial hypothesis, oftentimes there are other things you can learn. One of the best stories that I remember hearing about is, I don't know if you, have you ever heard the story about Kevlar? It was designed as like some kind of metal coating for, I want to say cookware. And it just turned out that it was like, boy, this is a really super high tensile strength thread. And I bet you if we could, maybe the story's completely wrong, but that's what's sticking in my mind for some reason. But there are lots of stories over the years where something that appeared at first glance to be a failure actually turned into a great success somewhere else, right? And so we see lots of interesting opportunities around how to pivot and being agile and flexible and iterative in our approaches. So we've been talking about this for a while. Tina, what kind of takeaways, leave behinds, what would you, to people listening to the DevCast, what would you say you want them to take away? What are the big things that you want them thinking about for the next several months? We're going to do the Catalytic Think Tank again next year. It sounds like our big takeaway from this session was that we can't just modernize systems. We have to focus on how do we collectively modernize ourselves and others, right? How do we modernize people? What do you think are the big things that should be catalyzing those thoughts, calling people to action, getting them involved?
My biggest takeaway was really around successful execution of innovation and perhaps planning as well. Figure out the team that you need to develop for this effort. Perhaps it's phase teams, you know. Get a 360 view of the problem. Celebrate the differences of these teams. We talked about this a lot. You know, have a mechanism to recognize the teams and successes and failures. Trust is huge in innovation. If you don't have trust, it's really your baseline need for a successful execution and proper change management. And at the same time, staying flexible is super important because occasionally your direction is going to change. Actually, a lot of times your direction is going to change. You'll start at point A, you think you're going to point B. Well, really the next step is going to point C. So I think keys to successful execution and really looking at your innovation process and perhaps your definition of innovation as an organization, along with your innovation strategy. Do these innovation ideas align with the strategy, your strategic goals? I think that was the biggest takeaway for me.
Awesome. So, and you're coming again next year, right? I'm assuming this was worth your time.
Absolutely. I could have been there all day. I was bummed it was a half day.
So, Tina, I want to say thanks for joining us on the DevCast and during the event. You know, and that's one of the biggest challenges, I think, has been kind of around this idea that it is intended to be kind of a closed discussion. We intentionally designed it that way because we want people to have trust and be honest and have those kind of fulsome conversations. we try to stack the panels with people that don't pull punches and kind of be and can deliver it straight. And I think that's been a huge part of it, right? I think everybody at this point is really, they've had their fill of kind of the corporate speak, and they're ready to solve problems with other people who want to solve problems. And so that's kind of the community and the level set that we've tried to set for the catalytic think tanks. I'm grateful to you for coming on and talking with us about your observations and your impressions. I'm glad you had a great time. Overall feedback was very positive. And on that note, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. Tina, I want to thank you again for coming and spending some time with us, sharing your observations and your insights on the April 5th event. Again, anybody who's listening who attended and participated, my heartfelt thanks to you. You all are what made it work. If you weren't able to get in the room this time, we look forward to continuing to engage. Keep that innovation wheel turning. Keep that light bulb lit. Keep the needle moving. And we'll see you all again on DevCast. Thanks so much. Talk again soon.